As you will know, the Buddhist tool set in establishing what he felt was the truth of impersonality was not belief. We're no bit freer when we just believe we don't exist or there is no self. That doesn't actually address the issue of self. What addresses the issue of self is the sober investigation that such an investment in self produces more pain than happiness and is empirically falsified wherever we look closely. That's his tool set. So by believing, by trying to believe we have a self-shaped hole, as I said yesterday, doesn't actually really address our issue of grasping and identification. So it's good to know yourselves. Floor is open. I'm curious to hear. Where does it feel like self? Yeah, please, just speak.
For me, and when we were talking, is to do with my thoughts, my emotions, my achievements, and my difficulties, the history behind me.
This all belongs to you?
Well, it feels that it belongs to me. I mean, I can see, as I said it, the caveats of that, but yeah. That's what it makes me feel, that it's a me.
So history, thought, emotion.
Achievements, yeah. Achievements and difficulties.
Failures also?
Failures, yeah. and also getting older and losing things that I associated with self or with, that's what it is.
So, we have quite a bit there. Thought, emotion, achievement, success, but also failure, loss, history. Okay. Quite comprehensive. Good group. Other voices, please.
All this, what was just said, but also I feel very strongly my body is myself. I identify very strongly with my body.
Which parts in particular?
Everything.
The trimmed off fingernails, or?
Well, yeah, it's a part of myself as well, but it's disposable.
Good. Other things. Body? Yeah. What else did you come up?
Everything that lady said as well.
It's a good list, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Body, obviously, we're very much feeling that these are our bodies. We identify with these bodies. The Buddha thinks to be actually, this is my most potent investment of self, the embodied nature. He gave it a clinical term. It's called Sakkaya Ditti, personality view, with the embodiment view, which, contrary to embodiment, which has very positive connotation in our circles, the embodiment view, the feeling of being placed in a body and being the recipient of the sensory experiences of that body, is rated to be a dangerous attachment. Yeah.
Well, when we were coming up with examples of things that I thought was self, and then when I thought about it more, I changed my mind. So, like, with your thoughts, it's like, your mind's like, you're not your mind. And thinking about, say, when you go to call a friend, and then they call you as you're about to call them, you're like, what's going on? Like, this is not just me. And then with body, thinking, well, without food, we would die. And when you eat, it then becomes part of your cells. So it's not just you on your own. If it was just you on your own in a void, you would just die. But then something like talking about pain, think if you feel a pain yourself, although then we're like identical twins, they sometimes feel each other's pain. So, yeah, it was difficult to come up with anything. I couldn't think of anything that was just me. And like Sue, we talk about it to do with your conditioning, so your thoughts, and is to do with maybe your childhood and things that other people have said to you. And you're meant to, like, your whole, you know, I think you're meant to, every single one of your cells dies in like 7 or 10 years or so, so you're not actually the same. So the cells you've got now, you don't have any of them in 10 years, so how is that us? So, yeah, it was it was interesting. Anyway, I was just going to put off on a slightly random tangent, but
yes, that was lively. Thank you.
Shame. When the emotion of shame, it seems to stick very much to a me. It's not there's shame over there or there's shame. I am ashamed. I feel shame.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, potent image. Thank you.
My views, my opinions, my judgment of something that I really want to fight for, argue about, convince somebody that how I'm seeing it is right. But there is some. It's not just about right, but it's about me. Almost like I'm defending myself. It's very strong for me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Good example. Yes, please.
The interaction that we have with people, so the way that we interact with different people, I think helps define who we are.
So you become more of a self if you and I talk.
The relationship and the way that I would see our relationship together being, I think that I would then define myself through my different interactions with different people.
Okay. So reification takes place through interaction. Thank you.
We talked a bit about that too, about how I become aware of a sense of self when somebody gives me back an image of me which doesn't correspond to something that I seem to have constructed. I'll get upset or feel flattered or something. So there's something in
Could that also be helpful?
It can be helpful, I suppose. But yeah, it can be helpful.
There are psychological schools which insist you need to be mirrored before you can actually establish a coherent sense of self. Thank you.
I was trying to come up with the idea of consciousness as that's myself, something underneath everything that seems to exist.
Where did you find that consciousness?
Well, it's here. I sense it.
Okay.
When things get let.
When you say sense it, which sense would you particularly associate with consciousness?
I think it's beyond senses.
Okay.
Like a presence.
What does it feed on?
Well,
we've heard suggestions of self so far. They have fed on achievements, they have fed on relationships, they have fed on emotions, they have fed on bodily symptoms, they have fed on views. What would the sense based on consciousness feed on?
I think it might be what's there when you take away self-identity. So self-identity is a construction of all these things you described.
Yeah, and underneath would be something called consciousness.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And yet, we can't actually pinpoint it and say it's connected with our hearing or with our liver function.
No.
Yeah. Good, we'll keep an eye on this one. Thank you.
Sorry, just adding to that lady's list, but just picking one out of order, there's also the issue of possessions. We all possess a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
We work for it, we've chosen it, we acquire it, it's mine, it's not yours.
Yeah.
And that reinforces my sense of me.
And if I get that wrong, you sue me, isn't it?
But there's also, there are other things that to add to that, there's you know, skills that I've studied for. And achieved and exercised. There's a family that I've created, my children, my grandchildren. They wouldn't exist without me. And all that reflects back onto the fact that I'm here. It's me. But those are all just basic factual things. There's also a kind of conceptual thing that we were working on over here, which is when something goes wrong, it's me. You know, when I'm in pain, when I'm wet or I'm cold, it's me. But when it's a lovely day, when I feel good and outgoing, the whole world's fine. When the sun shines, everything's great.
It's an interesting
observation. And me kind of disappears a little bit in that context.
You become a universal, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Irish eyes are smiling, the whole world smiles for you.
Great example. Then, yeah.
Yes, we also talked a bit about that and about how much more how it's when something negative happens, it's so much stronger. The self thing, if you like, is so much stronger than something positive. And we talked about patterns, habits, you know, we're creatures of habits. And we talked about animals quite a bit as well, how they are, you know, animals, even animals have personalities, habits.
Do they have selves?
Well, that's an interesting one. I mean, we'll talk about instinct and one thing. Is instinct part of self? Or is it not at all self? I don't know.
That begs the question, you know, the inquiry was, what makes me feel like self? So your question would presuppose a self already to, and then find out whether instincts are part of it. So I would think this is cheating with my question. Yeah, Brenda.
For me, it's a history and, for example, preferences that connect me with myself when I was little. I loved to swim. I can remember loving that when I was very little, before I could swim, I love water. I still love to swim. And there's a sense of me ongoing in that because my sister didn't like water. So that's who I am.
Uh-huh. So, tactile immersion, huh?
And
into liquids.
Mm. And there is a comparing in it, I think, too, knowing mm-hmm. that...
She doesn't,
not,
and I do.
Not everyone does, but I love it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So a distinction there, very clear. Okay, thank you. Please.
I was just thinking actually when you ran something we were talking about consciousness. Actually, when I felt into it, it was just a desire to have an enduring sense of self, to have something that continues in that idea of an enduring self.
Yeah, yeah, it's a very deep and widely shared longing, that, no doubt about this. Yeah, it's good to know that longing. Other voices? Yeah, please.
I was thinking, I mean, it came to me in the beginning, I was wondering about when I might not feel a sense of self in a bad way, and I was wondering what I'd feel like if I lost all my memories. People have talked about history and achievements. And it's quite scary for me, the idea that I woke up tomorrow and I don't remember any of that, because part of my experience itself is a strong attachment to memories. And I remember when years and years ago there was a chance that all our possessions had been lost. I won't go into why, and they weren't. But the thing I minded most about was the photographs, which, because they were irreplaceable, they were part of my life, my experience. And we thought they might have gone, and it was pre-digital.
Yeah.
And it was deeply, deeply upsetting. But I could imagine if I woke up with amnesia tomorrow, some sense of myself would be damaged, but maybe there is still. I don't know. It's just
I'm sure, but you know, you'd have other options for self. As you know, people with Alzheimer's still have violent emotions and...
Yeah, sure. But
you could get an emotional self rather than a historical self.
But it would change. I mean, I suppose if I think of the sense of self as being made up of a mosaic of experiences, for want of a better word, the memory bit is very key to
I guess this seems to be emerging as a picture, isn't it? We have a mosaic type of sense of self.
Yeah.
Memory, I'm sure, is key, is part of this. Yeah, as the guy who is the protagonist through all the events I can recall, and when the recall falls away, the protagonist is under threat, isn't it?
And you talked about the Buddha as autism yesterday in that article. I mean, some of my work is with autistic children, not just a therapist, but anyone like them.
Yeah.
But I'm very aware their sense of self feels very different.
Yeah.
And I can't relate to it, and it's a real problem. That's huge. And I'm talking about extreme, no language
all sorts of things. And I suppose it's this lack of things that I have then throws into what my experience of self.
Would you feel that some of the kids you're working with do not have a sense of self because they do not, they may not have language?
No, because I work with 0 to 5, and so we watch the language develop. But there's something about communication, patterns of communication.
That affirms self, and that's different with them.
Affirms and develops, and it's changing self in relation.
That ties in very much with what Francesca said, isn't it? The affirmation of self that comes in being mirrored, in being affirmed.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you can calm a crying child by mirroring their facial gestures when they're very small.
Yeah, and by validating their emotion, isn't it? Resonating with their emotion, and they suddenly become more calm.
I mean, I'm not a therapist or anything like that. I just work with children.
Interesting. Other ways of coming to self, Gaetan.
I'm asking myself a question. Why is it so important for me to say something? And the next thing that comes along is that, I mean, while I was having the dialogue, and it came afterwards actually, is that I do want people to agree with me. And the other thing is that when somebody doesn't agree, there is contraction in my body. So I'm reminding of this me. There's almost a fear about people disagreeing with me. So it's very important, but I'm asking my question. I think it answers a very solid answer when I ask myself, why is it so important for me to say something? And I must add, I noticed that there's a lot of eagerness in this room for people by the amount of hands that are going up to say, I want to talk about what it means to be me.
Don't agree with you, Doug.
Let's play with that for a moment, Gaetan. You know, you don't spell that out, but you make it sound like it could be a wish for public validation, isn't it? Yeah. I project my little self outward if I'm being publicly agreed with by a great number of people that basically affirm, yes, I exist, yes, I'm allowed to exist, yes, I'm a clever member of my species, and this is being publicly validated. Yeah? That kind of sort of is flattering in some way. But there may be another part of this. You know, if you want to look at this developmentally, then for the larger part of our career as Homo sapiens sapiens, our survival directly hinged on our capacity to be members of a group. We could not survive on our own, as we still probably find it difficult to survive on our own. Our life has changed a little bit, but, you know, 100,000 years ago, survival was directly necessitated you being a member of some kind of clan that was looking out for you, that you were part of, that you identified with, that went about finding food and protecting it against saber-toothed tigers and so forth. And being disagreed with meant you were left out there, you know, you were food. So our fears around public invalidation, which we, you know, this is ranked, I think Jack Kornfield, this little numbers is, you know, if you ask people about their fears, fear of dying ranks about number 5 down the list. Fear of public speaking. That says something maybe about their developmental history. It doesn't just say something about pathological shyness. So it says something that we deep down have a lot of echoes of, we need to belong somewhere, otherwise we're basically food out there. And yet, it's inaccurate, isn't it? You could happily sit here, disagree with everything being said, not say a word, and nobody would threaten you, nobody would chase you out with the dogs, nobody would, you know, nothing would happen. And yet it is difficult to be in a group and disagreeing with be disagreeing with the group and not say anything. Yeah. This is difficult. It seems to challenge the validity of our experience hinges a lot on what others say, what others are capable of resonating. There's a developmental need for us to actually be validated in our stuff we feel as kids. If that doesn't happen, we have some significant issues later on. And yet, I wish to participate, be seen participating, and project that inner notion of self outwards and have it validated outside goes way beyond that need, isn't it? As you so cheekily point out, the eagerness. Yeah, thank you. There was another voice there.
Yeah, I was going to add on to, I suppose one form of external validation that we sometimes seek is in the case of people who have had avoidance attachment experiences as young children, when the child feels that they need to focus on very intensely on the feelings of the parent in order to get any attention themselves.
Yep.
They can actually be so focused on the feelings of others that they're not in touch with their own feelings.
Yeah. Quite
which,
common.
Which can create a really confused sense of self.
Yeah. They're beautiful helpers, isn't it? They're exquisitely attuned therapists later on. They're highly appreciated social organizational skills folks who and run whole organizations without having to attend to their own needs because they're so damn good at looking at other people's needs. I'm highly familiar with that fact. We compensate, isn't it? We start, we have decided what, very early, long before you think a straight thought, you will have decided what your best options are under the given conditions of your immediate environment, whether you get whether your chances are better to get what you need by being aggressive or by being sickly or by being particularly charming and devoid of any needs, and or mummy sunshine or daddy's willing helper, or we've decided very early on what is needed in terms of our context that would then promise us to get what we need in turn. Other voices? Yeah, please.
I was just, when you said, if, in the previous example, when you said if you disagreed with what was going on here, nothing would happen. I don't know, I think that would be, I'm not sure, it would feel like it did, it would feel like, I suppose if you didn't express it, but if I sort of said, I think this is, I don't agree with anything that's going on here, and I think I feel like people were looking at me and kind of judging the view that I had.
Yeah, but they probably wouldn't throw you to the wolves.
Yeah.
They might
think you're... I don't know people here, so...
Well,
I'd have to check the history and, where people came from. I guess what I'm saying is that idea of ranking the fears, I'm starting to see why that one's quite high and fear of dying is a little bit lower. I suppose the other thing was, I'm not sure if it sort of links with that sort of sense of shame or getting things wrong. There's also this process that you want to do that, that process is a way of growing as a person, to get things wrong. That's how you learn, if you like.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That must be all wrapped up in self.
Well, I guess you'd need somebody in there to identify what you wish to do and what you wish to avoid and what skills you throw into the you know, to develop this. I'm sure something needs to organize something there. Yeah. Yeah. Last one.
I think most senses really allude to the feeling that I am me.
You mean most sensory experiences?
Sensory experiences.
Yeah. So faculties.
Because I can do this, and this finite sort of experience of my body, and I see other people, and there are gaps in between them, so there are other entities, other things, and things come to me. It seems as if I'm the center of the world. You know, things come to me, sounds, smells, everything.
Very accurate, yeah. Thank you. I give you my own list, yeah, just for honesty's sake. It's been very self-revealing. I want to match that. I came up with a number of ways. One of them, I also sense I'm the occupant of this body. I'm basically the tenant here. That's clearly how it feels. I do not believe that. I know enough about bodies, how they metabolize, how they change the cells, how even the things I ingest, which is the most violent type of appropriation, they don't really belong to me. They go into a sort of a digestive process about which I have actually, with my voluntary intention, very little say in. You know, I'm not actually having much say in what happens to the croissant I ate this morning. I trust somehow it goes to the right place and moves on from there. But I don't actually have sort of from a self position much say in what's happening now once I have swallowed it. So I definitely feels in a non-investigated way, it feels as if I'm the occupant of this body. I am the beneficiary of Vedana, of pleasant and unpleasant. It feels that I'm at the receiving end of lots of pleasantness and unpleasantness in my life. Yeah, lots of woos and lots of whoa. Yeah, this happens to me. It feels that this all kind of converges here, and I have lots of interests there to get things right, really right, and not get things that I feel are wrong happening. I feel I am the recipient of emotion, basically. There seems to be a correlation. The stronger the emotion is, the more it feels like me. Yeah, sort of a mild, wistful little melancholy doesn't really feel highly personal, but you know, a full-blown depression does feel like me. It's kind of an anger attack does feel like, you know, the universe is just one big unfair construction that I am now going to redress with the help of my rage. Yeah. So that definitely, I am the recipient of emotion. I am the beneficiary of pleasant and unpleasant experience. I sense sometimes, you know, good days, I feel authorship for my life. I feel I'm kind of directing creative expression. Yeah. I tell a joke. This may not be a great creative expression, but it's kind of, I'm doing this. There's somebody called me who's telling the joke, who's taking care of the timing, who's delivering a little, a little fun. I also sense I'm the agent in my life. You know, I make decisions. I'm calling the shots here. I say where things are going. I get up, go to the loo, or I say no, or I have to own up. You know, I take responsibility, even if for the stuff I botched. You know, I have to take responsibility. But also I take the credit for things that are good, for things that seem to have worked out, for skills I have developed, for things that have succeeded. And that just habitually feels that way, even after many, many years of Buddhist meditation practice. I do not believe this, I do not actually affirm this, but it still feels in a sort of unquestioning way like it's me. Oh, this is me. Yeah. I'm doing this. I could falsify any single one of them. Yeah. There's things in this body which are a lot older than my concept of self, you know, little mitochondria which have been handed down with every cell mitosis, which do probably think of me as a fairly opinionated current host organism that is really there to deliver their important mitochondrial message down the line of evolution. Yeah, they think I'm the vehicle, while I think I'm the pilot. I know that these vedana are highly unreliable, and I know that some of the vedana that have been pleasant suddenly become unpleasant, or some of them that have been unpleasant have become pleasant. Or I know that I have very little say in whether I experience something as pleasant or unpleasant. I may feel it is pleasant, and then I may feel it is unpleasant a moment later because I start to feel this is immoral or this is inappropriate, or I may feel I wish I had, I wouldn't have this. This is distracting. There's all kinds of things which, if I'm seriously believing that I'm the recipient of Vedana, then A, that makes me feel totally vulnerable, because so much in my life I cannot control. Yeah. Renal failure, can't really control this. Kidney stones, yeah. Can't really control this. Am I going to be pain for the rest of my life just because I have pain? I hate to think that. You know, I hate to think that my life is now, the organizing feature of my life is now pain, and yet we know pain does quite powerful things to us. If we don't have pain, we think this is normal. If we do have pain, we hate to think this is normal. We like to go back to a normal before the pain. If it threatens to be staying with us, then we feel greatly diminished. So, being the recipient of my pleasant and unpleasant experience is not a ticket for happiness. Even if I get pleasant right now, I think most of what I heard from you falls into one of these categories. There's another one which, in view of Buddhist teaching, is probably the most tricky one. It is basically that at the core of my being is something that I cannot put my finger on, but at the same time that this is the essence of me. The example with consciousness comes closest to this. All the other examples you have said are forms of a social self, or form of a bodily self, or a volitional self. All these could be said are patterns of an empirical self in some way. Maybe with developmental echoes, even developmental stages that are absolutely needed. But the issue is not that it feels that way. The issue is that we would just gullibly go along and believe that such a local, episodical feeling of self, what Buddhists call acts of selfing, actually constitutes a metaphysical, genuine, reliable, capital S self that stays on and forms an immutable core of our being. It's the confusion between these two, which the Buddha says is really risky. And obviously he also says, whenever we grasp at a self by identifying, yeah, with the body, with our feelings, with our actions, with our successes, with our hang-ups, with our failures, with our social role, whenever we grasp at this, we're going to pay a price. This is going to hurt, because that self you have now grasped at is going to change. Under your hands it's going to change, and it'll turn into something else, and you will experience loss and grief and rejection and invalidation. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So I think this is a good opportune moment to stop. Just consider, it's important for us to have valid experiences of feeling, this feels like a self, and validating this experience means we are capable of investigating this experience. If we try to invalidate it, it stops being an object of our investigation. And as that, it makes our contemplative practice ineffective. We need to acknowledge where it starts to feel like me, where this solidification, where the reification of a me sets in. This is the activity of selfing. You'll agree with me that this activity is going to produce some form of pain. While it initially feels powerful and validating, I am somebody, I'm allowed to be, I'm important, I'm big, I'm skilled, I'm competent, I'm wise. This kind of peters out. When I sit on the loo, I don't feel particularly wise. Yeah? When I wake up in the morning, I don't feel particularly intelligent or effective. I feel I kind of come from another place. And you know, there's this body expands, gradually senses coming back, gradually remembering who I am, gradually associating with this protagonist with all the things he hasn't done yet or he needs to do. And then the story gradually assembles. Yeah. We all know this. We go through this every day. We cannot construe a metaphysical self out. Experiences have no, whatever experience has, have no intrinsic insight. They have no intrinsic insight. Every experience whatsoever, the most lofty one, the most horrendous one, if I identify with that experience, I end up in an empirically maladjusted way. I end up solidifying, reifying something that is of momentary nature. And my attempt to construe out of that momentary experience, however valid it is, something enduring in time, I end up being wildly off the mark in terms of adaptability, in terms of competence. That's what the psychologists would say, but the Buddhists would say in terms of happiness, in terms of freedom, in terms of awakening. It's just a maladapted moment, a moment frozen into a self-construct. That is quite explainable out of the many things you have mentioned, and yet that does not actually constitute something that takes me out of time, or that takes me out of change, or that truly constitutes me. And it does not deny individuality.